The president's Supreme Court commission released hundreds of pages showing how they want to change the court system in America for political ends. Hi, I'm Stuart Shepard, and this is First Liberty Live. Before we get started, thank you in advance for liking and sharing our videos. That's how we meet new people. That's how we get the word out. You are an important part of this project, and we appreciate you for doing that. Our guest today, Jeremy Dice, he is our special counsel for litigation and communications. You need a bigger business card to fit that onto here at First Liberty Institute. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Stuart. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. Good to chat with you again. Let's start with what is weird about this. The presidential Supreme Court Commission released basically a month in advance what would be, I would describe them as, these are the working documents they had out of the different committees that they set up, and they said, here you go, and we'll have the final report in a month. What's this, what does that tell us about what they're doing and the significance of releasing it early?
Yeah, the White House called them draft preliminary discussion materials, which is a wonderful Washington, D.C. term for a draft document in which the commission is going to debate further. And from that, I think, draft a report, which they said will come out about a month from now in another meeting. And from that draft report will come the final report. So this is kind of a draft of a draft of a final.
Yeah.
And so this is sort of like going back to high school and putting together your outline and your all of your study materials together, from which you'll eventually write your draft report, and then eventually from that, edit it down to your final report that you'll submit to the teacher for its final grading.
This tells us what they talked about in the sessions, but it has very little bearing on what they're going to recommend when they get to the end, is what I'm hearing you
say.
Yeah,
it was a little bit of a test balloon, I think, for the commission to sit through and to discuss, okay, where do the commissioners really sort out on these issues? And I think we're beginning to see where they're sorting out on that. First of all, because two commissioners actually resigned over the weekend, having reviewed these draft preliminary discussion materials in the commission meetings that had preceded them. So they're no longer a member of the court,
right,
or a member of the commission. That's significant because those were conservative members that were on that, and there aren't that very many of them on that commission.
Which would suggest, perhaps, and we don't know because they didn't say, but suggests that they didn't want their name on this final document.
Yeah, we don't know the reasons. They didn't state the reasons. But yeah. I think the other thing that is said is interesting is that the commission, in their discussion, the commissioners themselves came to some very stark positions that are contrary, A, to what the progressive left has been drumbeating the entire time that they want to see happen from this commission, but also contrary to the positions that they took at the outset of the commission meeting, which I think is very interesting, and we'll get into that maybe a little bit later.
Yeah, and the White House made clear, I think I mentioned this, the president won't comment on this until next month after the final thing is out. So we just have to wait, and in the meantime, we get to talk about it. So let's talk about what they talked about. First, court packing, which for those who haven't been following this all along, it's important to explain it. It means adding additional empty seats on the Supreme Court and then filling them in order to change the balance of the court. Where did they come in on that?
Well, interestingly enough, I think that position, which was the impetus for driving this whole thing, and by the way, I should have pointed out at the outset, these are, in fact, the preliminary draft discussion materials right here in my hands.
You had a long weekend,
you can
didn't
see
you?
That I had to take a lot of the paper of our copier to get these all things to print out.
Yeah.
Each one of them represents a different stage of the considerations, and one of them includes the court packing issue. And I say that it's all but dead because I think the commission has largely come to the conclusion that is a politically untenable position to be able for anybody to take.
Yeah.
And it is perhaps the highest hurdle that could be out there. And to their credit, I think the commission did very well to sift through the many historical examples of which they've tried to do this in the past, and it has floundered and failed every single time. There's a reason it flounders and fails every single time.
Summarize for us why it's such a lousy idea.
Because they can't figure out how best to do it without it undermining democracy.
There is that problem.
Right? Yeah. I mean, they point to the experience of other countries, A, in support, but also as a word of caution. And specifically, as we've raised many times here, Mike Berry, my colleague, has done a good job of writing on this, as have several others, is that in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez destroyed the judicial independence of their courts. And they point to several other countries in the report to say that, yeah, when they've actually begun to expand these courts, it has been a way for the current political leadership to undermine judicial independence and further solidify their political power. And so there's a real distaste for court packing that is arising out of this commission, which I think is very helpful. Now, I'll be quick to underscore, there are still members of this commission that are adamant for court packing. And so that threat is not fully disposed with, but I think it is becoming, it is certainly teetering on its feet right now as it approaches the end line.
And members of the Senate, we should point out, have already suggested that that should be done and have introduced legislation to bring that about. We often talk about in the political realm, we talk in terms of liberal, progressive, we talk about conservative. But to help get clarity on what this is really about, that's not how you look at the Supreme Court. There's a different way of looking at the members of the court, and it's not liberal, progressive, and conservative. It's how they view the Constitution and how they view their role in interpreting it. Unpack that for us.
Yeah, look, and the court actually, or the commission, spent some time reviewing some of those details as well. And the final analysis basically is to say that there is a different ideological perspective that judges bring to the table. And those sort of and sometimes align with political parties, but not always. And that's why it's very difficult, whether we're talking about court packing, are you going to have Democratic presidents or Republican presidents expanding the court based upon their terms or term limitations, which we'll get into in a moment.
Yeah.
How do you do that? The danger that the commission rightly points out is that this will actually create more partisanship rather than less. There's a reason why our justices wear black robes. It's to give the impression, which ought to be the case, that they are unbiased, that there is not even their clothing that would distinguish them from one another. There's a reason why the lady justice is blindfolded, right, to make sure that there is this independence and sort of removal away from the process, that they bring an independent flair to or neutral aspect to what's in front of them. And the same would be said for the justices themselves, for why they don't typically align by a registered Republican or registered Democratic justice or judge. In these cases, that they're given that level of independence, that removal away from the political process, to ensure that what was written in the Constitution is effective and is governing our society writ large.
And Al Mohler pointed out in his commentary that came out this morning, I was listening to it on the way in, that the separation of powers is really based on a Christian principle, which is you can't trust people. I'm paraphrasing what he said, but essentially, humans are sinful, therefore we need these balances of power at the highest level in order to keep us all safe from the excesses of individuals.
If you read through these materials carefully, what you should come away with is a really profound appreciation for the Constitution. Why? Because if you think through this commission as sort of a constitutional convention 2.0, how would you rethink Article 3 courts, for instance? If you read through this, you see all these roadblocks that are set up, mm-hmm. that the Constitution throws in its way. And that's purposeful, and that's very, very good for us, because we don't want our judges, our judicial independence, to be subject to the whim and fancy of the political issue of the day. And so I came away reading some of these documents going, thank goodness for our Constitution that so wonderfully restrains the political impetus to do something. They even state up front that this is largely driven by the fact that there has been, quote-unquote, controversy around the last couple of judicial picks, driven heavily from the progressive left and all this. Thank goodness we have a Constitution that stands above that fray and sort of silently guards the process, silently stands watch over our country's freedom and our individual liberties. If we did not have that Constitution, I can't even begin to think where our country might go, not just when it comes to our judges and our judicial independence, but when it comes to our precious and civil liberties like religious liberty and other free speech elements and all the other things we know and cherish well. Had we not had that Constitution, we would be in a whole different world of hurt right now.
One of those freedoms is the right to petition the government, and we collected nearly 500,000 signatures, and I went on the commission's website and found where they posted the letter that we penned here at First Liberty, all the names that people would recognize that signed on to that, including a former attorney general, various leaders around the country, Christian conservative leaders and others, but also the 500,000 people who signed on to that. And I noticed that in the draft report, they note the public opposition to the idea of court packing. They heard us.
I think they really did. And there is a real outcry among this. And we should thank those of you who are watching that have signed on to that. And if you haven't yet, you can continue to add your name to that at supremecoup.com. But uploading 432,000 or whatever number it was.
It's still growing. We're still taking names. But
right. Yeah. But I tell you, just the physical structure of having to do that is a bit of a chore. And having to receive. look, someone actually had to sit down in some bureaucratic office somewhere and review every single one of those names. And I thumbed through that, by the way, and there are black marks over some names that had to be removed. They were email addresses, not names, actually, that were inadvertently left on there. And so somebody had to go through all 430-some-odd thousand signatures on that. That alone is worth it, in my mind, to make a bureaucrat have to do that. But that our commission actually sat through and appreciated those comments and then had to report out, the public seems to be decidedly against the idea of court packing and some of the other proposals that are on the table.
And I'm obligated to point out that the idea has also been publicly opposed by Justices Stephen Breyer, Clarence Thomas, Amy Coney Barrett, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, before she passed, went on television and expressed her opposition to it. When you have justices that far on the left and that far on the right, who are both saying that something's wrong, it's really wrong, but yet it's still a live ball. They're still talking about it.
Well, like I said at the beginning, these are historical examples. There are many historical examples of efforts to try to engage in court packing, and every single one of them have been defeated. In our public comment, as a matter of fact, we quote from a Senate report that talks about that not only should the idea of court packing be rejected, but basically the earth should be salted that from which that grew. The commission actually quotes that exact quote in their report, as a matter of fact. So I don't know if they picked it up. I like to think that they picked it up from our public comment. Perhaps they read it independently, but regardless, thank goodness for those senators back in 1937 for having the political courage to stand up and say, no, we have a constitution that we have to defend here.
Another topic that they discussed at some length is the idea of term limits for Supreme Court justices. What did you see in that?
Well, that one seems to be the most politically palatable one. And the idea would be that justices, rather than having life tenure, that they serve during good behavior, as the Constitution says, that they would be limited to a period of roughly 18 years. And the way that that happens, who gets to appoint them and when, it's something like every president gets two picks during his administration or her administration, and they kind of rotate out that way. There are all kinds, again, here are the roadblocks that the Constitution is throwing in the path of subsequent generations from trying to mess with. Thank goodness that it does. There's a lot of problems with this. Term limitations on their surface seem to be a very good idea. We have them on politicians. A lot of state courts have term limitations as well. But the problem that we're going to run into repeatedly, and this is a good thing, is that you would have to amend the United States Constitution to make this happen.
Right.
And that seems to be inescapable. You have to amend the Constitution. And we know, based upon polling that we commissioned and the Wall Street Journal reported on a couple of months ago, about 70% of Americans consider any amendment to the Constitution on court reform dead on arrival. And I think that's very, very telling of where the American people are here, that they like the Constitution that we have. They don't want it to be tinkered with. The people who formed this thing back in 1789, when that Constitution was finalized, they had surveyed history well to understand the need for judicial independence, that separation from the crown and other different forms of government. And we ought to leave that alone. Subsequent generations have this kind of temporal arrogance to think that perhaps we've evolved to a heightened standard of understanding when it comes to these issues. I don't think we have. I think the Founding Fathers stated it very well. I'll read later on from what the Federalist papers say about it, because I think it summarizes it very well.
Well, let's talk about someone who was on the commission who had an opinion about this and then appears to have changed that opinion. People who follow the legal profession know the name Lawrence Tribe. He's professor emeritus at Harvard. At one time, he was considered a likely pick for the Supreme Court. He often shows up quoted in news articles about the courts and the court system. He's also reliably liberal, no surprise there.
In fact, a co-founder of the American Constitution Society, which is sort of the antithesis of the Federalist Society. So it's kind of one's on the right, one's on the left, this one's on the left.
So reliably very liberal in his thinking. We have a clip from him on Friday when the commission met online, and he starts out by saying he thinks adding term limits would probably require a constitutional amendment, and he says his opinion about that hasn't changed. But then he goes on to talk about his attitude toward the idea of term limits. And he'll be, as you watch this, this is from their online meeting, so he'll be in the top right square on your screen.
I began, as some of you did, including Commissioner White, with an assumption that of all the possible changes, this would be the most obvious one that would be relatively uncontroversial, widely supported across the spectrum, and probably beneficial. The course of reading and studying what has been generated in this chapter convinced me to lean very much in the other direction. I no longer think it's likely that this would be a good idea. I think what's really broken, as Commissioner Balkin points out, is the Senate. I don't think we could solve that problem by having more confirmation hearings. And I think that the difficulties of implementation, how one would deal with the paralysis of the Senate, with the vacancies that might not be filled, and with the unintended side effects of term limits, lead me to conclude, in an exercise that really illustrates the value of this process, lead me to conclude that something I began by thinking was a good idea, I end by thinking is probably a bad one.
Big deal for someone who's focused so much attention on the court system for so many years to have a change of opinion through the course of this. Unpack that for us. What's so significant?
Look, I think it is a significant idea. Number one, he was going to be the pick for the left had Bush lost, right? He could have been Chief Justice Roberts right now, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
He would have been the chief probably at that point. And so this is a liberal lion of the left, and he is now saying, hey, the left has gotten left of me, and this is a problem. I thought we could give some ideas to this, we could give some consideration. We can't. This is a problem. Second, I think he points out a very important issue here, and that is that the system, the Constitution, is not broken. The way that the judges and justices of our federal judiciary are selected, appointed, and confirmed, that's not a problem. And even the outcome of that, of the so-called bias that the left has portrayed some of our justices or judges as having, that's not an issue. What does he say is the problem? The confirmation
Senate.
Process. The Senate itself
yeah.
is the problem. And what does he say? That's not something that we can solve. Who can solve that? Well, the American people can solve that. When they see people going after judges or judicial nominees in completely unfair ways, with like the American Bar Association went after our friend Lawrence Van Dyke and made him cry at his confirmation hearing with completely unfounded accusations that were wrong and frankly untruthful.
Yeah.
The American people have a right and a responsibility to remind their senators who they work for and to remove them from their office when their tenure comes up again. And so that situation is solved politically, not through the machinations of this commission. And third, I think the important thing, I think I'm up to number three now, the important thing to take away from that is his insistence on, and it's kind of subtle underneath of this, but it is the judicial independence that is necessary here that term limitations will not solve. He's in good company because there's a little book we call The Federalist Papers. And if you're not familiar with The Federalist Papers, this is sort of the commentary on the United States Constitution written by John Jay and others that were sold to the people of the United States to encourage them to adopt the Constitution when it was being promoted to them and explain why this is important and how it functions. And
John Jay, who was the first Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Correct.
Yeah.
And some others as well.
And some
course.
Others.
Hamilton,
yeah.
And I think Madison was the other one.
Yeah.
So in Federalist number 78, this is the section of the Federalist Papers where they're talking about the Article III course, and they're specifically talking about the independence of the judiciary here. And lo and behold, what do they consider? Term limitations. And whether that is adopted by individuals, so the people that vote, whether it's adopted by the executive as appointing new limitations, or by the legislature insisting upon limitations, this is not a new thing. It's almost as if Solomon knew what he's talking about when he said that there was nothing new under the sun. In fact, we go all the way back to the Federalist Papers, and here's what we read in Federalist number 78. That inflexible and uniform adherence to the rights of the Constitution and of individuals, which we perceive to be indispensable in the course of justice, can certainly not be expected from judges who hold their offices by a temporary commission. Periodical appointments, however regulated, or by whomsoever made, would in some way or other be fatal to their necessary independence. What Alexander Hamilton is writing in Federalist 78 is no less true today than it was then, that if we tinker with our Article III courts and we put limitations on them, the Constitution says that they are to hold their offices during good behavior. You'll have to change the Constitution to allow them to serve during limited time periods, term limits. And if we do that, we're actually not furthering judicial independence and achieving the left's purported goal of you know, reigning in an out-of-control judiciary that actually does not exist.
Yeah.
We would actually undermine the independence of our judiciary. And why is that important? Because the independence of our judiciary is the last bastion of protection for our individual civil liberties, including our religious liberty.
So those are the two big topics. Those are the headlines. What else did you see in there that caught your eye as you read through it?
Yeah, a whole grab bag of other proposals that are out there. There's a long discussion about stripping jurisdiction from the Supreme Court. And we've actually done that. The legislature has done that. And to some degree, I'm sympathetic to that idea, that the court, that the legislature could, through reasoned argument, debate, and voting, say, you know what, we're going to remove this one from the table. In fact, the Constitution allows them to do that. And so while I'd be generally oppose the idea of stripping jurisdiction just willy-nilly through the kind of...
What do you mean by that?
So that the court could hear certain cases but not hear other cases.
Such as?
For instance, the Defense of Marriage Act removed the ability of judges to insert their own opinion on the definition of marriage. The Congress set what their definition was going to be within that act. And there are other areas. For instance, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act and RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, require the judges to apply a certain level of judicial review within their things. So this is kind of the negative and the positive of when it comes to jurisdiction setting and stripping for the justices here. That has a lot of how does that work out kind of questions when it comes to right down to it. But if the legislature actually does engage in that and the people's representatives in Congress, both the House and the Senate, come to a conclusion that we're going to take this element off the table, well, at least we would have had a democratically reasoned argument and debate about it, and that would have been pulled off rather than this kind of wholesale conclusion of off of their heads, all of them. That is being pushed by the left right now. And so that's an idea. And there are other issues out there, like whether or not they could have a Supreme Court that would be this sort of all the Article III judges are a part of the Supreme Court, but then they're going to have little panels that will be designated sometimes by lottery systems. They're going to get the ping pong ball machine out, and up will pop Lawrence Van Dyke for one and Jim Ho for another and whomever else for the third. Yeah. They would hear different issues. It creates its own problems, and the documents, frankly, bear that out, because the commissioners can't really figure out how best to articulate it, even in their own documents. And at the end, they're left saying, we don't really know how that would work out, so maybe we shouldn't pursue that, but here it is for debate. I'll be interested to see what the draft report says, and then ultimately what the final report encourages from there.
You've talked about this a little in that part of this, but I thought it interesting when they noted the various changes they were talking about, that some would require a change to the Constitution, others would not. And I think most people are surprised to learn that there are changes that the Congress, the Senate in particular, could impose on the courts outside of a constitutional amendment. That's a new thought for a lot of people.
Yeah, no, and in fact, one very important thing that has rarely been exercised, but the commission actually points to here that I kind of remembered, hey, that's actually important for us to consider, is legislative override. And so there is actually a mechanism in our Constitution right now that if the Congress doesn't like how the court has ruled on a particular issue, if they can get two-thirds of the Congress to agree, so both the House and the Senate, two-thirds of them to agree on that issue and override that specific decision, they can do so.
Hence checks and balances.
Checks and balances and separation of powers. That's exactly what our Constitution is put together for. So here again, we see the silent safeguard of the Constitution sitting there, making sure that our Republican democracy is protected and the rights that are preserved within the Constitution are well and truly preserved for future generations.
All right, what happens next?
Next is about a month from now, the commission said they will have a draft report issued, and right on the heels of that, they'll meet again.
Not the draft preliminary, but the draft without the preliminary.
Exactly, and they'll meet to discuss. This will actually be the draft recommendations that they're going to send to the president, and they'll meet one more time to discuss that in that kind of Brady Bunch framed style that we've come to know and love of that commission online. And they'll have that discussion publicly, then they'll take that back, and within about a week or two, I think that they will finalize that draft into some sort of formal final proposal that they'll then give to the president to do with as he wishes. And from there begins the real political debate about what this president and this Congress are going to do. As you observed earlier, there is a bill in Congress right now to expand the court. There's actually two bills to expand the court right now. And I think that'll continue to be a debate all the way through this administration, because the left, the far left, that is, will not allow that to go unheard.
I'm going to give you just a moment to summarize this whole thing for us before I let you go. How would you put a bow on all of this?
The importance of judicial independence that was written by Hamilton and others shared at that time is no less important today than it was back then. It is the foundation stone upon which our civil liberties hang. And if the judiciary can be turned into another political branch, then our democracy, our Republican democracy, I should say, hangs in the balance. But more importantly, our individual rights and liberties to whether the freedom of religion, the free exercise thereof, et cetera, hangs in the balance as well. And the good news about that is because of people that are watching this show and others, because they have voiced their concern about this to the commission, I think the commission is now stepping back and saying, you know, the left has gotten a little too far ahead of their skis on this right now. This is probably time for us to pull back on the reins, reconsider these issues. And as you heard Lawrence Tribe say, I've changed my mind, and I think we need to change our mind generally as our approach to this thing changes as well.
Very good. Jeremy Dice, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. Lots of good stuff in there.
Thank you.
All right. And if you'd like to learn more about all this, you can drop by a special website that we've set up. It's supremecoup.com. That's coup, C-O-U-P.com. That's where you can learn the facts, truth, and history behind the brazen attempt to overthrow the court system. You can still sign your name to our letter in opposition. There will be a pop-up when you first land there at supremecoup.com. It'll take you to the page where you can do that. This week at our usual time on Thursday, we'll hear from a man who became a Christian in communist China and was put in prison for his faith and then escaped to the United States. He has a lot to say about where we are in the scheme of things here in the United States right now. It's a powerful story, and you can hear it right here on First Liberty Live.